This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. You know, you walk through the halls of our nation's great institutions, and you will more than likely find paintings and statues honoring the great men who founded them. But what about the people who designed and actually built those great institutions one stone at a time? At Duke University, students took a long, hard look at who is and is not recognized in the school's institutional memory. And it comes after the removal of the statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee from the entrance of the chapel last year. Duke University archivist Valerie Gillespie led the research project that homed in on Duke Chapel and the West Campus. Val, welcome. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Also with us is Caroline Waring. She is a senior, a rising senior, who took part in, actually rising junior, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're a rising junior who took part in that project. Caroline, welcome.
Hey, thank you.
Val, tell us about, remind us of the decision, because this is really part of a process that began to unfold with the removal of that statue. I mean, talk about that process and the impact it had.
Sure. So last August, the statue was removed, and that really sparked a campus conversation about how we remember our history, what we know about our history, and what we don't know about our history. So through discussions over the past year, the idea to look into the laborers who actually built our iconic buildings came up, and we decided to take advantage of a summer research program to make that happen.
And what did we know about those groups, or what do you have to do when you take on a project like that?
We knew a little bit about them. We certainly know about the architect and the chief designer, Julian Abel, who was recently honored with the renaming of the main quad at Duke. We knew a little bit about some of the stonecutters who worked on the chapel and some of the other buildings. But really, we didn't know much at all about the day-to-day laborers who were doing the work in the hot sun and the cold winter. So what we had to do was find old ledgers that told what the payroll was. It said who was working on a particular week for what wage and for how long. And then the students really took it from there.
And you mentioned Julian Abel. That was an interesting story for a long time, and an untold story about the black architect from Philadelphia who designed the chapel and who actually couldn't come and see it unless he was incognito, right, because of the Jim Crow laws. He had to kind of sneak in under cover of dark just to see his own project.
Yeah, it was very unusual to have an African-American architect design a school that was segregated in the Jim Crow South. And Abel's role has been recognized by the school more officially in the past few years. And I think that is part of the continuing interest in understanding our history.
So now you want to get at the workers. So what did you find out then on that first gloss as you begin to dig into the archive?
So we were working with a team of students led by a graduate student named Hannah Ontiveros, Caroline, Jake Satisky, and Gretchen Wright. And one of the first things that they noticed was how many hours a day people were working. People were frequently working 11, 12, even 17 hours a day, multiple days in a row. So it really told us something about how much people wanted these jobs and needed these jobs.
Well, and you should talk about the period. When are we talking about? This is
sure.
The early 30s, right?
Yep. So the chapel was built between 1930 and 1932, and West Campus, which the chapel is on, was built between 1927 and 1930. So we have the Great Depression kind of in the background
of this. So any job is, you know, a good job in that sense. Caroline, tell us about why you decided to get involved. What's your interest in this?
Yeah, so I'm involved in a couple activist groups on campus, including like People's State of the University and Disorientation Guide. And one of the things that's a common thread among these groups is sort of uncovering the institutional history of Duke and what they put in the brochures versus what they leave out of the brochures and who is visible on the plaques versus like who is whose stories are unheard and untold. So I think I was coming at it from a perspective and an interest in like labor rights and the history of labor rights at Duke and the sort of common thread of black workers working underpaid and like and long hours and long weeks for the benefit of white students, and sort of this disparity in wealth and disparity of who's allowed to come to Duke versus who's building Duke.
Well, let's talk about the construction and what you found in terms of disparity. What did you discover?
Yeah, so we discovered that black workers bore the brunt of the sort of economic turbulence of the period. They earned about 68 cents on the dollar to their white counterparts. They were also working more hours per week on average, about 3 more hours per week, but this is also taking into account that a lot of the Black workers were more transient. They would show up for a week and then would disappear from the ledgers altogether. And so maybe they would get the opportunity to work about 17 hours a week one week, or they would have like an 80-hour week. And it was just sort of a lot more scattershot in that sense. But we also discovered that a lot of Black workers, although they would have the same skills as their white counterparts, the state and also these white union boards would deny them licenses. And so instead of being licensed to become a plumber, they'd be designated as helpers or a mechanics helper. We saw that frequently in the occupations of the ledgers that we went through. And that sort of also affected the pay disparity.
So first of all, they're getting paid two-thirds of what a counterpart at that job description would
yes.
get. But the fact is they were really qualified and probably working at a level that was higher that would have qualified them for even more pay. So
right.
you can understand why, as a supervisor, you'd want to assign those workers more hours because you're getting a discount, right? So you're getting more work per dollar. And what about the kind of work they were doing in terms of was it dangerous work? You know, do we know anything about disparities in terms of the kind of work they were doing?
Right. So Black workers were more often the common laborers and they were more often the helpers. And during this period, there were no safety regulations. And so we would have these photos of workers like lying up on the roof without any harnesses. There's no hard hats. They're just wearing fedoras, if anything. And we did have two recorded deaths that we discovered during the construction of West Campus and the chapel. One man was a foreman, and he died in 1930 after he fell from scaffolding, and he had sustained injuries and died about a week and a half later from those. And then another death occurred during the construction of the chapel when timber fell upon a man.
And of course, the absence of what we would now call the absence of safety regulations, that applied to everybody.
I mean, yes.
That was going on. What do we know, Val, about the narratives? Were any of these stories collected? Do we know much about the people who did this work?
Well, we know a little bit about some of them. Some of them were interviewed before their passing. These were mostly Italian stonecutters to learn about their lives. But what we struggled with was that most of the names in the ledgers were not familiar to us. They've all passed away now. And so the students really had to dig into a number of sources to try to understand, you know, what their race was, where they were born, were they from Durham, or were they passing through Durham looking for work? So there were a lot of unanswered questions, and there are still questions that we have.
How do you find that information? How do you figure that out?
The students took advantage of Ancestry, which had some census records and other things that were helpful. Telephone directories from the period are helpful. The Durham directories used to list occupation and race along with the address. Those are a couple of places we've started, but it will take some really deep research to try to find information about all of the 400-plus names that have been turned up so far.
You were able to find out the story of one African-American stonemason, right, who was recognized as a craftsman, as a stonemason?
Yeah, I think Caroline is the person that did most of that research.
What'd you find out, Caroline?
Right, yeah. So one name that kept popping up and that we actually had a decent amount of information on relative to other workers was Lucius Jeter. And he was a stonemason, one of the few Black stonemasons who worked on West Campus and the chapel. And then we also found that he worked on the Allen Building in the 1950s. And he appeared to have worked in Durham all of his life and given decades to the construction of Duke University. And it was particularly interesting to see this because stonemasons are one of the few skilled occupations available on this construction project. And so he would have been working alongside these Italian stonemasons and stonemasons from North and South Carolina and other Black stonemasons and getting paid a relative higher wage than the other workers on the site.
Yeah. It would be interesting to find out how he learned his craft if
yeah.
he had been here in Durham. You say he was here most of his life.
Yeah.
Tell us what you said you're a part of activist groups. You're already aware of the fact that names like this are being left out of the story. and that this should be put into the record. So you're already well aware of that and the need for it. Is there anything about doing this project that even deepened your sense of your understanding of this and the value of this kind of work?
Yeah, it's definitely one thing to claim that the university doesn't honor its workers, and it's another thing to go into the process of discovering who these workers are and making active changes to and like being on the ground in this sort of reclamation of history that we're doing here. At least that's what I kind of like to think of it. So I was really, I guess, shocked by just the sort of like numbers and just the stark facts of the working conditions of these workers, and then also just the humanity of seeing their names and their wives and their number of children that we can find from the census records.
And the fact is Duke is now undertaking this, right?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, like, they're funding our project, but at the same time, they're not going to put this history in their brochures, and they're not going to, like, market this history to incoming freshmen. And they're not – we also, like, they don't have plaques dedicated to these workers. We instead have plaques dedicated to donors. And so if Duke can start a sort of project in renaming its buildings after these workers, I would say that it's taking steps to, I guess, rectifying its history.
That may be the next step, but I want to thank you for being on our program. Caroline Waring is a rising junior who took part in this project. Duke University archivist Valerie Gillespie led the Stone by Stone project. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
And you've got a website, right? So we can see some of this work if we go to your website.
That's right.
Which you can link to at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, butterfly biologist Fred Nyhout. Oh, there's more on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.